a lot of people will tell you within the community of adoptees, you know, our life doesn't start the day we were adopted. There's this whole other time and space and family that existed prior.
Society in general, they don't really understand the implications of adoption. They just feel, well, you were adopted, problem solved.
I knew I couldn't stay where I was or keep living with that grief. So moving through it was the only option.
I know in African culture, that's extremely important that you're able to put yourself into, they call it the flow of time. And it feels like that my lineage has been cut with my adoption.
There's such value in being in community among other adoptees, and it was validating for me. So that really helped for me to get connected, and then seems as if the world just opened up.
If I'm the secret that everybody has held for 37 years, you know, who can I talk to? And finally, it just hit me. I have a choice here. You're affected from the moment it happens. You're impacted. But I needed to know that I was going to be able to come to an understanding and a reconciliation.
It's Jennifer Diane Gostin, and welcome to Once Upon a Time in Adoptee Land. Wouldn't it be empowering to have many of your burning questions answered here? Simon Ben did it again. Yes, the host of Thriving Adoptees podcast introduced me to my guest today, who, like him, was born in the UK, Scotland, to be exact. Her name is Heather G. Marshall. And meeting via email started my adventure, or should I say our adventure, of more discovery about meaningful parts of an adoptee story. Heather is an adoptee, coach, speaker, teacher, mom, nana, lover of wild places, especially rocky ones, and a published author. Her latest book, When the Ocean Flies, I devoured in a couple of days because of the layers of loss, grief, and reconciliation. I had no way of knowing how her novel would impact me and add depth to my lived experience. Her short fiction has been published in a variety of journals, including Black Mittens, New Writing Scotland, and Quarried, an anthology of the best of three decades of Pine Mountain sand and gravel. Her first novel, The Thorn Tree, released in 2014 by MP Publishing. When the Ocean Flies, Heather's second novel, through Vine Leaves Press, released in February 2024. Her TED Talk, Letting Go of Expectations, centers around her adoption and reunion. In addition to writing, Heather is a mindfulness and yoga teacher and offers mindful writing classes and workshops for adoptees. Heather immigrated to Ireland and then the U.S. She's currently based in Massachusetts. Allow me to introduce you to someone who, since our first conversation weeks before recording, helped me to put more words to my feelings as an adopted person. In this episode, we both learn new things about each other. She shares a part of her relinquishment, adoption, reunion journey, intergenerational grief, and how the false narratives portrayed of adoption lead to harmful and/or limiting patterns of living. She explores the ways in which adoption and the adoption narrative create a lack of trust for adoptees both in life and in themselves, not to mention the ways that this leads to a lack of a solid identity. Heather, I am going to try to contain myself with the excitement that I have for you to be a guest on here, because our connection just feels so, I'm going to use the word meaningful. Since the time that Simon connected us via email, I felt it. I'm supposed to get to know her better. I'm so glad you're here. So how are you doing?
I am doing well, and I feel exactly the same way. Just Simon sent through the connection and I followed up, and then we were chatting and just finding these things in common, and it's a delight to be here.
Yeah, and just before I push record, we discovered that we're both Tauruses. You're born in April and I'm born in May.
So yeah,
it just keeps going, the different connections. I wanted to first thank you for gifting me a copy of your book, When the Ocean Flies. And I know that I had sent you a text message saying that I'm up for a challenge because I wasn't sure if I would be able to finish it in time for the recording, which I always want to do just to be totally prepared. I think it makes for a very rich conversation. And your response was, I hope it ends up not feeling like a challenge. And I want you to know, I want you to know that it absolutely did not feel like a challenge. It was so good. And I left a review this morning on Amazon. I don't know if you're aware of that.
Oh, I'm not. Thank you so much. That's a whole other thing with, you know, putting a book out into the world. The algorithms like reviews.
Absolutely. Yeah. And when you spend time and hard work and effort and produce something like you have, you want the world to know about it. Yeah, it's just the next logical step. But I wanted to ask you, would you like me to read what I wrote?
Oh, I would love you to read what you wrote. And I haven't read it yet, so this will be a nice surprise.
Okay. As an adoptee in reunion with biological family members, Heather G. Marshall's book resonated with me in many ways. She put words through her main character of what I felt throughout times in my life as a relinquished and adopted person under a closed system during the 1960s. Heather's well-developed characters, writing style, pace, flow, structure, and the story itself was captivating to the very end. I experienced every emotion imaginable that beautifully reminded me of the power in choosing and living an authentic life, even when it is pitted against my hardwiring for attachment.
I'm tearing up a little bit and getting chills, goosebumps. Thank you so much for that. Obviously, writers hope for readers. That's, you know, a given. But one of the things that I wanted for this book, for it to resonate with other adoptees, that's one of the things that I hope for this book, that it's a way of getting our larger story into the world.
Well, I am so glad you wrote it. And I just see your audience being beyond the adoption community, that it really speaking to them. It's a powerful story. And on behalf of adoptees, I think we just appreciate when writers do what you did. So I think of the characters, Allison, her adoptive parents, Adam and Agnes, and her friend Vic, and Wade, and Mary, and Jimmy, and Maeve, and Ailey.
Yeah.
Her maternal grandmother. I really created space for Jane, the name given to Allison at birth before she was relinquished. And there were parts in the book that spoke to me in honor of her.
Yeah.
Yes. And I wanted to read something, if that's okay, that really moved me. Your words through that character, Ailey, really moved me. On page 67, you write, this is Ailey, the grandmother, the maternal grandmother, in one of her diaries. You write, "We have become afraid of the dark, become a people too fragile to look at anything other than the light. More and more, I believe this is a mistake. I believe the darkness deepens when we turn it away. Only when we look it in the eye, can we tame it? Perhaps these tales will reveal this to you as well, Jane. They are yours to make whatever you need of them. Now I must rise, tend to what needs tended. I hope, wherever you are, that the darkness in which you began has been more than balanced by light. Beautiful, beautiful. I just want to ask you, from what place those words come from?
Well, I first would like to thank you for that beautiful reading of it. That was lovely. Oh, where did that come from? I often feel that stories come through me as much as from me. I don't know if that makes any sense. When I'm in the moment and I'm drafting, I'm trying to be fully present and open. This character, this grandmother, you know, felt almost like a real person would. I don't know if you've ever had somebody who's maybe a mentor or somebody you really admire, and you're faced with a conundrum and maybe you can't access that person to sort of say, hey, I need your advice on this thing. And instead you sort of think, well, what would this person do in this situation? And I just felt her as a whole person with me all along once she sort of arrived on the page. I suspect if I pulled it apart logically, I would say that she came from, and her words came from, my own growing up experience with a lot of older women, my grandmothers and their sisters. So I grew up with a lot of strong, articulate women in my life. And they were women who had faced a lot of struggle in their lives and who were not afraid to look. In the case of this particular passage, we're not afraid to look at things that might be considered dark. And had the capacity to walk forward in their lives, you know, having had some significant darkness in their lives, and to walk forward with grace and with dignity, and, you know, to find the ability to hold the darkness and the light as they moved through their lives.
Yes.
So I had those beautiful examples growing up.
What a blessing. Yeah.
Yes.
I had them too. I had them as well. And how fortunate for us. Yes.
Yes. Very fortunate.
I have so much in your book with tabs on it. And I said, I'm not going to do that to Heather. I'm going to let her lead the way. I know you're a coach, a speaker, a teacher, a mom, a nana, a lover of wild places, especially rocky ones. You've been on a TEDx talk 9 years ago.
Yes.
Entitled Letting Go of Expectations. And I've watched it twice. I highly, highly recommend listeners to check it out. It's so well done, powerful. And I loved how you started out asking the audience to unzip their minds and hearts.
I have to give credit to the organizers for that, because the theme of the whole event that year was unzipping. And so I was sort of using their theme to, you know, introduce and sort of hopefully to guide the audience from, you know, the connection between one talk and the next talk, which on their surface were quite different.
Right. And you share part of your journey as a relinquished and adopted person. And I loved how you kind of wrapped it all up in rest in reality. That just really stuck with me. And so why don't you share a part of your journey in adoption land, as we say?
You know, I think and I said it in the talk, I'm a baby scoop era adoptee, which was post-World War II to, I think, the early 1970s, when there was, at least in the UK, a higher rate of adoption than there is now. I'm not sure that that's true in the US, but it's certainly true in the UK. And it was in a time when it was very frowned upon, to say the least, to have fallen pregnant if you were not married. And there were very limited options for young women if they found themselves in that circumstance. And that is how I came to be relinquished and adopted. And had the what was in that time the standard procedure, which was that I was removed from my mother immediately at birth. She was not allowed to hold me or anything. And then I think I hung out in one part of the hospital and she hung out in another part of the hospital for those first few days. And I know that was particularly awful for her. She was on a ward and all the other mothers were having their babies brought to them and she was not. And then I went to foster care. And that was also standard practice. And then after foster care, I went to my adoptive parents and grew up knowing that I was adopted. They, you know, followed the procedure that they were instructed to do, which was to tell me early and often so that it would just become part of me. I don't remember ever being sat down and, you know, having somebody say, this is your circumstance. It was just, oh, I'm adopted. Okay. And in Scotland, adoption law is different than it is in the US in that when you, the adoptee, turn 18, you have access to all the records. So you can trot yourself over to the House of Records in Edinburgh and they will show you your original birth certificate. I know in the US, original birth certificates are altered, and that is not the case in Scotland. So I was able to go and look at my birth certificate and discover the name of my mother when I was 18, which was a huge, huge thing for me. It was too much for me, actually. And I looked at it on microfilm and I left the House of Records without a paper copy. I was overwhelmed. I did go to an agency, the agency that had taken over the Church of Scotland records, to see if I could get more details on the birth, and sat down with a social worker and she asked me questions that I wasn't prepared for in terms of why did I want the information and what did I intend to do with it. And I left that office without the information. It just threw me for a loop, and I was not a particularly confident 18-year-old. And it took me a long time to go back. I eventually went back and got the printed copy of the birth certificate. But it actually took me another almost 18 years to get the full notes and decide to search for my mother. I found her in late 2004, I think, met her in 2005. She came over to the US and we met, and we have been in reunion ever since. And that has been, overall, that has been a great source of healing for me. It's somebody warned me, they told me before I met her, they said, this is going to completely alter your life. I didn't really understand fully what that meant. And it did completely alter my life for the good. The very first meeting with my mother, not the first day, she was here for a few days and we were having dinner one night and I could tell that she was staring at me in sort of a funny way. And I looked at her and I said, you know, what is that? And she said, I'm just taking you in. And I said, no, you're not. There's something else there. I can see it. And she said, well, it's not fair. And I said, what's not fair? And she said, well, he buggers off and you look just like him, meaning my natural father. they had been seeing each other and the relationship had ended for a variety of reasons, but he was not around then when I was born. So then that sort of that I had thought about finding him, but not nearly as seriously as I had thought about finding her. And once she said, "Well, you look just like him," I thought, "Well, that's it. Now I have to find him."
So, well, I would feel that way too.
And she was correct, absolutely correct. Yeah, I have only one picture of the two of us together. I'd met him a few times, and we went into Glasgow one time. My daughter was with us, and I said to her, "Will you take our picture?" And she said yes, and we turned to her, and she snapped this picture before either of us was ready. And not only do we look alike, but our facial expression is exactly the same.
Oh, wow. Let me go back a minute.
Okay.
Because I'm picturing your birth mom saying it's not fair, right?
Mm-hmm.
And how it made her feel to look at you and basically see him.
Right.
Yeah, like that's so interesting. And I'm just wondering, I guess she probably was going to be processing that for a while.
Yes. I think there's a lot that, so we're, I think this is year 19 of reunion for us. And I think there are still things that come up that reveal like, oh, okay, that hasn't quite been fully digested yet. And then there are sort of markers that come up that are evidence in the other direction, evidence that healing has taken place. And I don't want to tell too much of her story because obviously that's hers, but she sent me a message last year and a song had come on the radio that was a song that was popular around the time of my birth. And she said over the years, every time she heard that song, it just brought up this huge wave of shame for her surrounding my birth. And it came on the radio just randomly last year. And she said, "I realized as the song ended, that was the first time I'd heard it and I didn't feel any shame anymore."
Mm. Wow. I think that there is so much possibility in reunion to heal even more, like all those involved. I know it doesn't happen that way for everybody, or it takes longer. I always use the word yet.
Yeah.
And at the same time, I just think for me, reunion definitely played a big part in healing.
Yeah, I think it has for me as well. I think there is the power in just the knowing of where you're from and who your people are.
Yes.
And then if you are, and I know this is heartbreakingly not the case for a lot of adoptees, but if you are in the circumstance where you are accepted by your biological family, that acceptance is tremendously powerful. Getting to know them is wonderful. And for me, it's been wonderful, not just for me as a person, but for me as a mother. There are small things that I have noted in my children, you know, that I've thought, oh, I see that in somebody else in my biological family. And that was something that I obviously didn't have until I was in reunion. And obviously everything about our children is not something that directly connects with some biology. They're their own beings. But there were little, you know, little things like one of my kids' noses. I was like, well, that's a lovely wee nose. Don't know where that came from. It's not mine. It's not your dad's. I haven't seen that nose anywhere. And then there was actually a picture of this child with my mother. I was like, oh, it's her nose.
Right.
Look at that.
Yeah.
Yeah. So those small things are little moments of delight, I think, that are more delightful for adoptees because we haven't always had them. And just the ability to communicate about what has happened to us, to me as an adoptee and to my mother, having gone through that experience of having me and relinquishing me. I think it's been healing for both of us to be able to talk about it and answer each other's questions and have those pieces of mystery and grief be out in the open and have that potential to heal any shame that either of us or both of us carried for all those years.
Yes. I like the way you put that, grief out in the open.
Yeah.
Yeah. That sounds like a part of healing for sure.
Yeah, I think it tends to fester and become something else when we can't talk about it in a way that we feel is really understood. I think it's difficult for people who are not part of the adoption constellation, as kind and loving and empathetic as they might be, I think it's difficult for people to fully understand. Yeah.
Yeah.
Very healing.
And before we get back to your latest book, When the Ocean Flies, is there anything you want to say about your paternal side, your biological paternal side?
Oh, I'm so very glad that I got to meet my father. That side is a little more challenging. I knew him just for 6 years until his death. He died young. I'm sure some of you younger listeners, like, what do you mean died young? He was 65. To me, that's young.
To me too. Yes, I'll be 60 real soon, and that's young. Yeah.
I'm way too close to that. Way too close. And so, yeah, so I had 6 years with him. It was evident to me when I first got in contact with him that he also was carrying a tremendous amount of shame surrounding my birth and the treatment of my mother and all sorts of things. The relationship with him was a little bit like wandering around with an egg, a raw egg in my hand, if you will. You know, you can't drop that. It's just going to shatter. And I felt that I had to tread lightly. And he was a big part of the letting go of expectations sort of idea. Mm. You know, if I go in like a bulldozer here, this is going to go away altogether. So let me just be present with what is and see where this goes. And so it was a slower process with him than it had been with my mother. But he was, in many ways, really marvelous. I didn't quite realize the degree of this until he died, but he was a great gift giver to my children. You know how some people when they give gifts, you can just tell, like, they fully understand the person to whom they are giving the gift, like they've just nailed it,
right?
And they've gotten maybe a slightly quirky gift in it, or a card or something, and it's absolutely that person.
Yeah.
so that I bought a motorbike a few years into the relationship, and it was something I'd always wanted to do. And I got my motorcycle license, and I was emailing him about them and about this. And I get this email about 3 weeks later, and he goes, "Right, well, I used to ride bikes. I've gone out and bought a bike. Maybe we can ride the next time you're over." You know, so things like that. Like, this is a person who's making effort to connect with you, you know? So he died. His sister, whom I had not met, she's obviously my aunt, but I don't think of her in that way because she pretty summarily rejected me. So I had this lovely relationship with him. And I think I'm still friends with his brother on Facebook, but the relationship with that side of the family pretty much ended with his death. There are a couple of people I'm peripherally in contact with, but much closer to my mother's side of the family. Definitely glad I didn't delay any further going to find him, because we only had the 6 years. And had I waited I know I've read about other adoptees who wait and then their parents aren't there anymore. So I'm glad I didn't wait any longer.
Yes. And I'm glad you got to meet him. Yes.
Yeah. Yeah.
When you mentioned that he was still carrying some shame from back in 1967.
Yeah.
As far as the writing of your book, like the impacts of secrets and shame, the ways in which adoption and the adoption narrative create these false beliefs that lead to harmful and limiting patterns of living. Yeah. What do you want to say about that as it relates to your book?
So what I want to say sort of in general about secrets and shame and adoption is, you know, the wisdom was, and I think is, and I think it's right wisdom to let adoptees know very early that they're adopted. I think that's a good impulse. There was not space for me, and I think in the larger culture there's not real space. I think it's beginning to open up, but it's not there yet, to explore what that means and how it feels as an adoptee. And so at some point in my childhood, I was aware that being an adoptee meant that I was somebody else's secret. And I think I sort of internalized the idea that there might be something shameful about me. First of all, something that warranted me being given away, because of course, as a child, I didn't understand the dynamic of what it meant to be an unmarried young woman who was pregnant at that time. And I think children tend to, like, even in the case of divorce, they sort of go like, what did I do? How is this my fault? But at some point, the idea crept in, you know, from the culture that it's a shameful thing to be pregnant and unmarried. And I sort of processed that as, and I think Alison also processes that as meaning, well, I'm the product of that. I am that shame. I'm the embodiment of that. That's what I came from. When you can't talk about that and process it, I'll cite Brené Brown, you know, who's the shame researcher, and she's written a lot of books, and I think she might also have or have had a podcast. And she says shame needs secrecy, silence, and judgment in order to thrive. We have all three of those as adoptees. There's the secrecy, there's the inability to speak honestly about your feelings about it, and then there's sort of the societal judgment of unmarried pregnant women. I think that for a lot of adoptees and for Alison, that secrecy and the inability to talk about it means that shame, and Alison has a belief in the book that she's sort of fundamentally bad, that there's something fundamentally shameful about her, and it is a driver of her actions in her life, that she's constantly out to prove or to do things that would hide this inherent badness. So I think that's one element. And then another element is that I think when you're relinquished and you're then adopted, I think there's a tendency to skip the basic business of being a baby. And that the developmental thing that you're meant to be doing as a baby is you're meant to be just being there and having other people, your mother, sort out what you need and meet your needs. And I think a lot of adoptees, and Alison certainly does this, instead of allowing the room to read her and meet her needs, very early on, she's reading the room and reorganizing herself to meet the needs of her environment, of her adoptive parents. Not consciously, this is just something that she does subconsciously, so she'll be allowed to stay because she doesn't really feel safe there. That's one thing. And then the other thing is she has these secret feelings about being adopted, missing her mother, and she's being told that she's lucky and she should be grateful, and she's not allowed to voice her feelings of grief, of wanting to know more about her family. She's having feelings and having thoughts, and the whole society, her parents, the culture, everybody is telling her that that's not correct, that she shouldn't be feeling grief, she shouldn't be feeling badly, she should be feeling grateful, she's lucky, she has this better life. And I think it builds up a huge amount of lack of trust in herself. So instead of looking inward for guidance about what's right for her, she ends up always looking outward for affirmation and doing what other people want and what other people expect, and sort of becoming distant from herself. Does that make sense?
Oh my goodness, does it make sense, Heather? Everything you said there was just so powerful. I was like, wow. What really I'm sitting with at this very moment is when you said, skip the business of being a baby. Like, oh my goodness. I know for me, like, that just went through my whole being as a way to describe what many of us feel as adoptees, that we're expected to skip the business of being a baby.
Yeah.
Oh my goodness.
Yeah.
Everything you said, yeah, adoptees have told me over and over again. I certainly can agree that reading a room is of utmost importance. And it starts early on. You know, I was in foster care for 2 years, and I can only imagine as a 2-year-old when I go from this really loud household of 7 family members to 2 parents who are old enough to be my grandparents. You know, it's quiet. It's just quiet.
Yeah.
And I am at that moment like, what is going on? And I'm going to have to be very alert and pay attention to what's around me.
Yeah. And I think we internalize that. It becomes a reflex. It's a childhood coping strategy mechanism.
For sure. And as you put it, reading the room to meet the needs of other people, basically.
Yeah.
It's sad. Yeah, it's sad.
Yeah. And so then our adult work... some of it becomes learning to read ourselves and figuring out how to answer the question, what do I want?
Yeah.
Which is, for a lot of us, I think, a completely foreign thing.
It is. And it doesn't really happen till, for me and many of us, till much later in life. You know, Allison is, I think, approaching 50.
She is. I think that's kind of interesting, because I do think there are a lot of adoptees that when we hit that age where other people are having their so-called midlife crisis, and that, you know, they're out buying whatever they're buying, convertible car or whatever they're buying, I think for a lot of us, our midlife crisis is, hang on a minute, I've been living my whole life like Allison does, reading the room, what does everybody else want? I need everybody else's validation. And that sort of midlife time, that taking stock is, well, hang on a second, what do I want?
Right.
And then the sort of the moment where you're like, well, I don't have any idea. I don't even know how to do that.
So true.
Yeah.
Because I often wondered why it took me 8 years after my adoptive mom passed to search. You know, and I came up with a list of things. Well, you know, I'm parenting. I got this stressful job. I've got all these moving parts in my life. And I just remember right around 47, 48, saying enough already. I do know what I want. I want to search for and find my biological family, something I've always wanted to do.
Right.
And yeah, like I just stopped and decided, now is the time. Like, I do know. I've always known. But why I haven't moved to action on it, yeah, I had just been conditioned I was just going to say to do things this way. This is the way you do things.
Yes. And I do think that's a thing for a lot of adoptees, that they wait until their adoptive parents have died to do a lot of this stuff for a lot of different reasons. And I did not. I just got to a place, I silly me, I thought I could just walk past the house that was listed on my birth certificate. And that's all I was going to do. I was just going to have a wee look at where I might have lived had my mother kept me. And that was it. I couldn't not do it after that. I was just absolutely possessed by finding her after I did that. And I've had a couple of other adoptees that I've talked to, and they've said, oh, you know, I'm going to happen to be back in the town of my birth, and I'm just going to walk past the hospital where I was born. And I've said, no, you're not. You're not. And they're like, no, I'm not you. I'm going to do. And I've just said, okay, well, if you need to call me after you just walk past the hospital, I'm here for you. You know, and then you get the call. Where do I go to search?
Oh, I have a funny story about that. Yeah.
Yeah.
Real quick, I'll just tell it real quick. I've told it before, but maybe a listener didn't hear it. I had a coworker who was not interested in searching. No way, no way. I'm not interested. But thank you so much for letting me know that I can get my original birth certificate. And so he did. And he was thrilled about that, but not the least bit interested in searching. So a few weeks, now I don't even know if it was a few, it's more like a couple of weeks go by, and he comes to me and he says, guess what? And I'm like, what? I found my birth mother.
Yeah.
I just remember thinking, yeah, you are pretty excited about that. And he's in reunion and everything just unfolded for him in a beautiful way. And I really love his journey because his birth mother had told no one.
Oh.
And he's, you know, we're almost 50 years old at the time. And she had told no one. And she asked that he give her 1 week. And she was true to her word and told everybody, which was very difficult for her to do, but she did it. Yeah, I think back to the subject of secrets and the shame that many people carry, particularly I'm thinking of birth first mothers. When we let go of the shame, like something beautiful can emerge, and let go of the secrets and perhaps not even have or entertain secrets. Another topic of interest is the intergenerational grief and trauma.
Yeah. And I think that was part of my, the whole Ailey character was that piece. I think we would serve ourselves well to talk more about that. I think we, or the culture tends to think of adoption as this one person, this baby, this child being adopted, and that's that. And we're leaving out of the picture, you know, if we're in the situation where a young man or a young woman is in communication with their parents when the woman, you know, becomes pregnant and the decision is made to adopt, there are all these other people involved. You know, my mother's mother lost her first grandchild. And that would be me, right? I don't think my mother will mind me telling this. She also, my grandmother, my biological grandmother, she also held some shame surrounding this. And when I met my mother and we were going to go for me to meet my grandmother and uncles, and my grandmother at that time lived in a very small village in Scotland, and she was anxious about, you know, what people would think, the revelation of me and, you know, all of that. She settled herself to that and decided she was okay with it being, you know, sort of public or not worrying about what other people would say. So when I went to meet her, it was at the house of one of my uncles, and we pulled up and it was dark outside. I can see there's a glass door, and this little woman has her face, you know how you cup your hands over your face to try and see out in the dark? You know, if you're looking out from inside a house, you can't obviously see. And if you press your face to the glass and you cup your hands over your eyes, you can get a little glimpse. So she was doing that. And I could see that one of the uncles sort of pulled her away and must have been saying, don't do that, you're going to frighten her. So we go in and she's standing there and getting all the, you know, this is so-and-so and this is so-and-so. And she came up to me and she put her hands on my cheeks and she said, this is the happiest day of my life.
Mm.
And so she'd been carrying that wish for all those decades, that loss for all those decades.
Right.
Right? And not able to talk to anybody about it. Who are you going to talk about? No, nobody knows, right?
Right.
So there's that grief that's being held in the, you know, the previous generations. And then, you know, I think that the adoptee experience reverberates down. You know, a lot of us adoptees are wandering about with all the stuff we have that we haven't been able to talk about. You might not have processed by the time we have our own children. And so there's that sort of lurking in the background of our parenting. And then if we decide, when we decide to go and find our biological families, there's all of that to navigate with children. And I know my three children had different experiences, and I tried to explore that just a little bit in the book. One of my children, it took him a long time to reconcile, you know, this woman. This is one of my sons, and he's quite protective of me. And he just was sort of thinking, this woman gave you away. That's not a nice thing to do. And why would you invite such a person into your life? And so there's a lot of conversation around that, around empathy and understanding and it having been a different time and place and her limited choices and the capacity for openness and forgiveness. So there was that piece. And then one of my children, I don't quite think she could articulate what was happening, but I think somewhere in her brain there was that, wait a minute, this woman that's just come into our lives gave my mother away. What precisely are the rules surrounding when mothers can give children away? You know? And so there had to be that conversation and the reiteration. She went through a phase where it was very upsetting for me to leave her at all, like to go to the grocery store. It was obviously a frightening thing for her to reckon with. And so I had to go back and, you know, repeatedly say, I am never leaving. This is a different thing. I'm not going anywhere ever. You stuck with me. That I had not anticipated fully.
Yeah, the character in the book, Allison's daughter, Tori, I felt her anguish about that. That was hard for her to understand if she were safe. Yeah.
Yeah. And so that's a whole, you know, that's a whole other piece that we have to navigate on this journey, is how we're tending to our own children.
I'm so glad you touched upon the intergenerational grief, because I found myself while I was reading thinking about my maternal biological grandmother, who played a major part in my relinquishment. I just think she thought that was the best thing. Like, I've never been angry about that.
Yeah.
At the same time, while reading your book, I found myself, particularly when I read that passage earlier from page 67, that as the years went by, because I too was her first grandchild, I imagine the grief of having made this decision. Because, you know, with the passage of time, a lot of things change. You know, certainly the times have changed. By the 80s, even, the way society looked at unwed pregnancy was very different than the 60s here in the U.S.
And yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, like I remember friends I went to high school with being pregnant, and they continued to go to class, and they had their babies, and like it was not the same. I mean, it was not, the shame associated was not nearly as bad as the 60s.
Yeah, and I think also the capacity to move forward with your life, definitely more challenging if you have a child at a young age, but you wouldn't be shut out of, for instance, going to college or training as a nurse or
right.
And that you wouldn't be automatically barred from those things. And I know in the UK, you know, in the 1960s, if you were a young woman just brazenly wandering about with a child out of wedlock, there were a lot of places that just wouldn't have anything to do with you, for you.
Right.
And so there was also, there was the shame piece and also the practical piece of, you know, if I keep this child, how are we going to survive? And that shifted, you know, by the 1980s, that yes, it would certainly be challenging and still is today. Obviously a challenging thing if you are a young woman and you haven't completed your education or your training, or even if you have completed your education and your training, it's a challenging thing to raise a child on your own, if that's what you're going to have to do. But it doesn't have the shame piece that it had.
Right.
Yeah. When you and I were born.
Yeah, you're not shamed
like yeah.
unwed mothers were during the time of our births. Oh my goodness, we could go on and on and on. And I know you're going to read something, which I'm so happy that you accepted my invitation. I just wanted to quickly ask you, what's been the most meaningful and or challenging thing about being connected to the adoption community, you know, through the writing of your book and how many other ways you have connected?
It's incredibly validating to be part of the adoption community. You know, I've met people like you and Simon and lots of other people. And we have so many commonalities, even though we've been adopted in different circumstances, in different places. You and Simon and I around the same time frame, but that's not true of all the people that I've interacted with. And it's so incredibly validating and healing and empowering to be connected to people who really get what the experience is and who sort of mirror what the experience is. It's incredibly powerful, incredibly healing, incredibly validating. And so that's been a marvelous piece of it. I think one of the challenges for me, you know, making sure I have the self-care piece in place and that I'm doing it, the self-care. Also making sure that I have, and I do have friends who are not adoptees, who are not part of this community, who know and support what I'm doing, but they're good places to take a breath.
Like, yes.
I'm not going to talk about this at all. I need a palate cleanser for a minute.
That's so important. I mean, I don't think that can be overstated ever.
Yeah, because it's heavy. And people have these stories and you end up in contact with people who don't have good reunions,
mm-hmm.
No, who go and try to find their biological families and they're turned away or they find things they might not really want to know, and they have to deal with what they find. So there's a lot of weight, that emotional weight that you come upon, and that is welcome and something that I, you know, want to engage with and want to do and want to offer whatever help and support I can. And also I have my palate cleanser friends over here who are going to help me lighten that load a little bit in their own way.
So true. It is emotional weight that is just a part of the community because of the loss, because of the losses. Thank you for that. I appreciate it. And I wanted to do, in honor of your birthday and my birthday, like, it's just a gift that you're allowing me to give to you and myself in rapid fire, a quick 10 rapid fire questions, if you don't mind.
No, I don't mind.
Just for fun. Yeah, let's just do it for fun. Okay. I've never done this with a guest, so I appreciate you saying yes. All right. Cheeseburger or pizza?
Oh, cheeseburger.
Lemonade or iced tea?
Ugh. I'm from Scotland. What tea? I'm going to go with what?
What'd you go with? Iced tea?
No, I can't go with iced tea. I've never managed to integrate iced tea into my palate. It still tastes like somebody started to make a pot of tea and forgot about it. Sorry.
That's funny. Okay. Number three, audiobook or hardcover?
Oh, hardcover.
I knew the answer to that.
Yeah.
Text or calling on the phone?
Calling.
Me too. Red or white wine?
Red.
Red. Yeah. French fries or baked potato?
Oh, well, that's hard. I've never met a format of potato that I don't like.
Me either. Any kind of way. Mashed potato. Like, I love potatoes any kind of way. All right. We'll pass.
I'm gonna go, if I have to pick one, I'm going to go with fries today.
Okay. And that's the key word today, like right now. Like, somebody could ask me this tomorrow. Yeah, and it would be different. Still pictures or video?
Stills.
Yeah. Attachment or authenticity?
Authenticity.
Yes. Pen to paper or laptop?
Pen to paper.
I knew that one. Okay, here's the last one. Sunrise or sunset?
Sunrise.
Ah! I got that one right, too. The only thing we differed on, I would pick pizza today, right now. And probably iced tea.
Yeah, you know, I think 9 days out of 10, I would pick pizza over burger. But I've just had a conversation with my brother and my daughter, and we were talking about where we were going to go eat dinner tonight. And one of the choices is a place that has really good burgers.
See, there you go. Yes, it just depends.
Yeah.
Thank you for that. That was fun. So are you ready to read something now?
So my mind is on birth. And so I'm going to read two pieces, and I think I'm going to read them in the reverse order. So one of them is the very beginning of the book, and the other one is one of Ailey's letters, and it's on page 179. I'm going to read them sort of in chronological order, meaning I'm going to read the Ailey's letter first. And I think you'll see what I mean once I read. So this is it's about halfway through the book. So it's several journal/letter entries in. Another spring has arrived at last, clear and cold like the beginning of the month of your birth. Most of this is buried too deeply within Mary for her to recall. But I remember. Sometimes so clearly, I think I might not be able to bear it. April awakened the whole country with frost, Dunnet Head to Lizard Point. No sun to give a little sparkle. A low-hanging grey held the sky close. Refusing to fully open, the day inched forward. Morning wasn't yet finished when Iceland sent a deep depression south. In the east, a spitting rain. In the west, drenched Glaswegians sloshed home. All through the night and the next day, the rain continued above Hadrian's Wall. Gale-forced winds swept the water horizontal in the air. England sat, settled and sunny, while the ships docked at the port of Leith near Edinburgh creaked and rolled. Eiders, drawn by delicious mussels, instead sought shelter near the mouth of the water of Leith, tucked into themselves. Even these heaviest and fastest of the country's ducks were no match for the weather. I stood out in it, watching the mainland as though that would somehow connect me to Mary, tucked into a mothering home near the docks on the opposite side of the country. They said this was best, to send her far away, to keep the secret. They made the girls knit. I imagined her there, yarn around fingers and knitting pins, through, around, over, out, again and again to make the layette. The thrash of the winds outside, rivulets running down the window, conjoining and separating again and again, the sob of the other girls, the knitted stitches becoming one little arm and then the other, the matron's staccato, this is best, this is best, this is best. You, within. Later, Mary would tell me you spent those days bashing at her from the inside. She felt you knew, were angry with her already. Perhaps you were just matching the weather or hitting back at the matron. And then, suddenly, on the 13th, a lazy ridge of high pressure ambled down from the north, dry and warm and sunny, a relief. The next evening, I stepped out into the night sky to watch the aurora. It felt like a blessing. I thought of those girls in the home with Mary, hoped they were allowed to press their swollen feet into their shoes, to step outside, to receive this small blessing. Surely they deserved a wee glimpse at the lights, the Fearclis, the merry dancers. That spring, the aurora was a one-night stand. Later, Mary would tell me they weren't allowed out. They'd missed the dance. The dew again tonight, the Fearclis. Mary has moved too far south to see them. I'll be outside, though, under the black sky, watching, hoping that wherever you are, you too are under the kind of sky that offers dancers, that seems to bring blessings.
Wow. You read beautifully.
Thank you.
I am so glad you read this part, because this is really making me reflect, because my birth mother was also sent away. And I remember when I read this part, I just thought, it's a time, like when we're preparing to enter the world, you and I.
Yes.
At this, around this time of the year. And there's just sadness about what our birth mothers were experiencing prior to our birth. Yes.
Yeah. Yeah, there's a lot to deal with and consider there.
Yes, thank you.
You're welcome. So then the other little section is the very beginning of the book. And so I'll just read it as it is. The beginning of her story is buried. Pieces of it dot the landscape like a body severed and scattered. One shard in the basement of the House of Records in Edinburgh, another beneath the tide waters that swayed her mother to and fro, and the last on the island where it all began, held only by her grandmother, whom she's never met. Decades have passed now, and these pieces have fossilized, years of detritus accumulated over them. Still they are there, buried, silent, waiting until something in her bones, in her soft marrow, calls her home. 1967. Bright light, cold air. The nurse tightening the swaddling, hurrying down the hall away from the still anaesthetized mother. The newborn thrashing her head side to side, instinctively seeking sustenance. The familiar heartbeat, the vibrations of the known voice. These did not arrive. Days and nights passed. At length, a foster mother carried her out and away. The beat of this woman's heart was different, wrong. The child did not know where the first heartbeat went, only that she was desperate for it. Again, she wailed, thrashed her head. The woman lay her in a cot. "Be a good girl," she said, closing the door. weeks like this, until eventually the child stopped. She'd learned to lie quietly, dark eyes searching the white ceiling. "That's a good girl," the foster mother said. She'd followed her instructions, discarding the name and the knitted layette upon arrival, making a clean break. No attachment was to be formed. This way, no one got hurt. Months passed, and then in the fog of an early November morning, the foster mother handed the infant to the Church of Scotland Adoption Services. Her part in shepherding this baby towards a better life was complete. The child neither cried nor smiled as she took her place on the lap of the stranger. And so that's the beginning.
Yes, it is the very beginning. And I do agree that was perfect, the order in which you read.
Both. Oh, thank you.
Yeah, that was perfect. Well, in closing, is there anything I didn't ask you that you want to share?
No, I think this has been marvelous and thoughtful, and I so always appreciate just having the time to talk with another adoptee about what our experience is. I particularly, in this case, appreciate your reading the book and giving the book some time and space and heart on the podcast. Just thank you so much.
Well, it was my honor. It really was, and a privilege for you to be on and for us to talk about your beautiful book. It touched me deeply. And I didn't say this earlier, so I'm going to say it now. I see it as a movie or a series. Yeah. Like, I watch Netflix. I watch Netflix like crazy. And I could see this story being told on that platform. So I just want to put that out there. I don't know if you thought about it, but that's what I think.
Well, maybe someone will be listening and agree with you.
Yeah, I think it would be great. Because we do need this kind of narrative about relinquishment and adoption out in the world.
Yeah,
we absolutely do.
Yeah.
So I'll be sure and include in the show notes the links, any and all that you would like me to put in there. Again, listeners, Letting Go of Expectations, the TED Talk that Heather did, is so good. I don't know if you want to tell, because I love the story you tell me, but the backstory of how you even did that, the whole idea of doing TEDx would terrify me.
We're blaming Brené Brown for this. A friend and I had read her first couple of books, and I can't remember now which one came out first, The Gifts of Imperfection or Daring Greatly. But we were having a conversation about what we would do if we were to dare greatly. I sort of said, oh, if I was going to dare greatly, I would give this talk about adoption and so on and so forth. And so I'm thinking we're just having a casual conversation, you know? And then, you know, she's like, well, Heather, it just so happens that there's a place that you can do that here in town. And so I kind of couldn't back down then, and that's what started me on it. When I first sent the thing in, I thought, oh, they're going to say no to this and I'll be off the hook.
Right.
And then I can go back to my friend and I can say, well, I tried. I tried to hear greatly, but they said no. And they didn't say no.
I love that story. Thank you for sharing it. Yeah, Brené Brown has impacted me as well. Daring greatly. I have read that. And one of the things that always sticks with me from her work is, you know, you can either be in the arena or not. And I want to be in the arena, you know, and I just believe that it is there that I'm able to meet other people in the arena, such as yourself. And I can also, yeah, I can dare greatly. Yeah.
Yeah. I agree with you. I also obviously want to be in the arena. Obviously, a lot of people want to be in the arena, but I think it's perhaps more powerful for those of us who are adoptees, because I think one of the things that a lot of us lose as adoptees is our own sense of agency and empowerment. Mm. And choosing to step into the arena is to choose to reclaim that agency and our voice, and just to be fully ourselves.
Yeah.
Just like right out in broad daylight.
Absolutely. I knew I would enjoy this conversation with you. Thank you so much for taking the time to have it with me.
Me too. All the same on this side, Jennifer. Thank you.
Happy birthday, Heather. April 25th is right around the corner, and I'm happy to share the zodiac sign in astrology of Taurus with you. By both of our birth dates being around this time of the year, it was meaningful for me to hear you read your words about a first birth mother and likely what both of our mothers felt due to their relinquishing us and their hope through the decades for our well-being in their absence. The intergenerational grief and trauma that accompanies an adoptee being separated from their family of origin and how it reverberates up and down the familial line is not often explored in detail with my guests. I hope to remain open and willing to learn more about how extended biological family members are affected by the loss and the disenfranchised grief experience, much like that of the adoptee and birth parent. I appreciate the ways we were hopefully able to pique your interest about the riveting and beautiful book, When the Ocean Flies. I further enjoyed the reader's guide, especially number 6, about the main character. Heather wrote, Allison's deep, perhaps desperate desire to belong, or to at least appear to belong, drives much of her decision-making. In what ways is our desire to belong helpful to our growth and development? In what ways might it thwart or be harmful? Can we truly feel a sense of connectedness and belonging if we are pretending to be someone we are not? Thank you, Heather, for having this informative, fun, uplifting, and insightful conversation with me. I cherish the moments when I can exhale a wonderful sigh of relief by feeling a strong sense of belonging with another Earth citizen. I find you to be willing to hold space and face the darkness in balance to that of the triumphant light. I am reminded of the life-giving power when I rest in reality, let go of expectations, and have a non-attachment to an outcome through your extraordinary work. Birds of a feather flock together, as it has been said many times, suggest to me that two life forms, creatures or adoptees, in community can take flight with each other in harmony at a moment's notice, again and again. If you're an adoptee and would like to share your adoption journey, visit JenniferDianeGolston.com. If you like Once Upon a Time in Adoptee Land, leave a review on Apple Podcasts. Follow and or give, hopefully, a 5-star rating so others can find it too. During the course of your day, I trust you will tell at least one friend or someone who you believe might find value in it, because word of mouth is still the very best way for the show to grow. Thank you for being here.